Live on Tape, Work in Progress, a World at Work podcast about work, life, and everything in between. With award-winning radio host Tom Alexander and Workspan's Not Safe for Work columnist Charles Epstein. Here are your hosts, Tom and Charles.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Work in Progress. My name's Tom Alexander, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend and podcast partner. It is Charles Epstein. Hey, Charles.
Hey, Tom. Today, we are joined by Wharton professor Mauro Guillen to discuss his latest book, 2030, How Today's Biggest Trends Will Collide and Reshape the Future of Everything. Not some things, everything.
Yeah, everything. Wow.
Yes.
He's not cherry picking.
No. That's quite an ambitious undertaking. And spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Having read the book, he does not disappoint. It's what's the term? I probably should have checked in with Madame Epstein on the pronunciation, but I'm going to try. Mm-hmm. It is a bravura tour de horizon.
Wow.
I tried. Uh-huh. I probably mispronounced it, but I tried. I took a stab.
And incorporate Madame Epstein into the show. So at any time French comes up, you know, you just point to her.
Yes.
And she says it for you, and then we continue.
That is a great idea, and I know that she'd be happy to make that small contribution to the show.
Yeah, I'm sure she would.
Yes, indeed. I'll run it by her. I'll run it up the flagpole,
Please do run it up the flagpole.
Yes, the old tricolor. I'll run it up the tricolor and see what she has to say.
Please do.
Anyway, as I was about to say, yes, it's quite an engrossing read, so very much looking forward to that. You know, Tom, speaking of trends, I was talking to a friend the other day. Mm-hmm. He's an accountant based in Northern California, and during the pandemic, he's working from his main office, and he hates it. He was complaining that he can't turn it off. He works 9, 10 o'clock, and he can't shut it down. He asked how I do it. I'm sure, you know, you and I have been working from home for quite a number of years. I'm sure you also have crossed paths or spoken with friends, or they ask you, hey, Tom, how do you do it? How do you manage it?
I do get that, no question. And I don't know if I've got a go-to answer on that, Charles. I think I just improvise along the way. Some days are more intense than others. And when they're intense, they're intense. I've gone from, and I'm sure you have too, 7 in the morning till 1 the following morning.
Oh, yeah. You know, my first response to him was simply, well, you know, I've been doing it long enough where I can pretty much come to a hard stop, shut the door, and move on with my life. And he just shook his head. I can tell. Mm-hmm. He just doesn't think he's going to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And then we moved on to other things. And I mentioned several shows. You know, we're just talking about this, that, and the other, going around the horn. And I mentioned several shows I binge-watched recently. And he was conspicuously quiet. And I said, Steve, apparently you're not a binger, at least when it comes to TV series. He admitted he wasn't. And then it dawned on me, you know, a lot of people talk about mindfulness as a way of clearing your mind, finding peace and balance. And it occurred to me that, you know, maybe cultivating a little mindlessness might also have some use.
Yeah, it does come in handy. I'll tell you, I've admittedly gotten pretty good at it. I don't have to work really hard for that.
Yeah, it just come by it naturally.
Oh, I mean, really? I'll tell you, it's like breathing. I'm telling you.
Yeah, you're born with it. That's very impressive. You know.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, not that binge-watching a quality TV show is mindless, but, you know, it is kind of a mental vacation, particularly when contrasted with, you know, the mental activity that goes into your work. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, you know, maybe if Steve cultivated more mindlessness.
Yes.
You know, carved out a couple of hours each day, be better able to draw the line between work and non-work and not be so stressed about it, you know?
Absolutely. It can calm things down.
But, I mean, I don't know. I know you watch a lot of sports, particularly watch baseball. I know you watch Eagles football. I don't know if that falls under the heading of mindlessness.
I don't think so. I think that falls under the definition
of anxiety.
Well,
if you have a rooting interest, it falls under anxiety.
If you're an Eagles fan, it's anxiety. But I was going to say a distraction, more of a reset, I guess you could say, or a redirect, if you will. But yeah. I wouldn't call it complete mindlessness.
Yeah, you know.
I mean, again, if you're watching the Eagles, maybe it can be mindlessness. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not really that good at mindlessness. I mean, I can be mindless, you know, unintentionally. I could be saying something and somebody could construe that as somewhat mindless. I hope not, but occasionally, depending on the subject, depending on who I'm talking to, depending on the circumstances. But, you know, generally speaking, you know, I need to be putting something in my head. I need to be improved, you know, which I guess is why I spend a lot of time reading, which is obviously not mindlessness, but I guess it's a form of alternate reality.
Yes.
Which also can be, you know, highly useful, particularly if you're looking for a refuge from work.
Yeah, definitely. And I like your point about self-improvement and things that you want to be better at and excel at. And I'm actually this weekend, believe it or not, I'm starting my first foray into the Chick-Corea Academy. What is that? That is an online lesson, live lesson with the great one himself, jazz legend Chick-Corea. So I get to actually, with a couple other guys, sit in a room, in a virtual room, and sit down, and we're at our own instruments, and he's at his, and he talks to us about music, and we actually put it into play and pick up things, learn from the master.
Well, how cool is that? You know, it's kind of interesting you mentioned that, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We do, full disclosure, we already spoke tomorrow, so the interview is recorded. But there's one point where actually in his book, he talks about 70 being the new 55. And the course of speaking to another friend of mine, I mentioned that to him. And he says, well, in a way, you could say 70 is the new 20. I'm like, what are you talking about? He says, well, to the extent that people are really trying things for the first time. And when you're 20, when you're that young, you know, you're just figuring out what it is you want to do, what you have an aptitude for, what really, really excites you. So a lot of people these days, they're 65, they're 70, and they're taking a flyer and they're just doing things that they never thought they'd do. They have the time, they have the interest, the opportunity is there. So, you know, I think that's a great thing. And kudos to you for, you know, doing this Chick-Corea Academy. I wish you all the best, and I need to know all about it. So this is just over the course of a weekend, or is this an ongoing thing?
It's an ongoing thing. I decided to start with a month of literally a month of Sundays. So Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock Eastern time, I hop into this virtual lesson room with Chick and a couple other folks, and we get to pick his brain and maybe even play a little bit together with him. And it's pretty, I'm very much looking forward to it. As you well know, he's been one of my heroes for decades and decades, musical heroes. Yeah, I'm excited about it.
Yeah, you know, that is actually quite inspiring. So inspiring that I may actually be emboldened to try a little mindlessness.
Yes, yes.
I do want to try mindfulness too, having taken a couple of stabs at it and failed. But I don't know, maybe mindlessness en route to mindfulness. Maybe that's my journey.
Yeah.
That's my truth.
I think we need to change the old tune, try a little tenderness, to try a little mindfulness.
I think that's a good plan. Anyway,
on that note,
looking forward to speaking with the good Professor Mauro Guillen on his new book, 2030, How Today's Biggest Trends Will Collide and Reshape the Future of Everything.
And we will speak with Professor Guillen right after these words.
Data, the mantra of business today. It's nothing new to World at Work, It's no small feat that they've been collecting data on salary issues for its salary budget survey for more than 45 years. Think about it. 45 years. Curious to know how your company stacks up? HR execs in the know rely on World at Work's Salary Budget Survey. Shouldn't you too? Go to worldatwork.org/salarybudgetsurvey to learn more.
Standing tough and the stars and stripes we can tell. This dream's in sight. You've got to admit it at this point in time that it's clear. The future looks bright. On that train.
Today, we are joined by Wharton Professor Mauro Guillen, who holds a Zandman Professorship in International Management and teaches in its flagship Advanced Management Program and many other courses for executives, MBAs, and undergraduates. An expert on global market trends, he is the author of the recently published book, 2030, How Today's Biggest Trends Will Collide and Reshape the Future of Everything. And it is currently on the Wall Street Journal bestseller list. The world as we know it today will be gone by decade's end, leaving us with a bewildering new reality driven by a new set of rules. Posing the question, will you be prepared? Professor Guillen joins us right now. Mauro, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom, for having me on your podcast.
It is wonderful to have you. Please say hello to my good friend and partner, Charles Epstein.
Hello, Charles. Thank you for bringing me in as well.
Oh, our pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us. I have to say, 2030 is a real page turner, perhaps not something you'd expect from a Wharton professor, with all due respect to the literary chops of your fellow business school professors. So,
well, we try to be as entertaining as possible. But I love that you use the term page turner, because that's what we need to do right now. I mean, we need to start turning pages so that we adapt and adjust to this new reality that is forming just before our eyes.
Yes, although full disclosure, I read it on my Android device, so I guess it was sort of a page, what do you call it? Swiper.
Swiper.
It was a page swiper. Yes. You know, I think we're going to need to revise the way we do blurbs these days. Anyway, reading it, it just sort of struck me that it falls somewhere between Yuval Harari's Sapiens in identifying salient trends and presenting them in counterintuitive, sometimes highly provocative new lights, and Kahneman and Tversky's work on cognitive fallacies that distort our thinking, authors whom, not coincidentally, you cite in your book. Is that a fair description?
Absolutely. And I'm flattered, of course, that you chose those two authors and books to compare mine to them. And that's exactly what I'm trying to do. What I'm trying to do here is to bring to the attention of people all of these big trends that are going to change our lives. And also to remind them that as human beings, we all have our biases, and therefore it's extremely important to adopt the right attitude, mindset, when it comes to dealing with those changes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, I have to say, you know, the sweep of things or trends you cover in its 200 some odd pages, at least that's the that's how many it was on my ebook, which is also a topic you cover, ebooks, frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, the sweep is just very impressive. You talk about everything from the impact of global warming to water scarcity to immigration, more women in the workplace who are amassing more wealth, the sharing economy, blockchains, various applications, emerging markets in South Asia and sub-Saharan Africa, and more. But if there's an organizing theme, it's something you call lateral thinking, which is something of a lens you view all of these trends through. If you would, please explain what you mean by lateral thinking.
Well, once again, as human beings, we're hardwired to essentially make connections that are linear, and they go from one thing to the next. But we really don't usually consider, as we're making decisions throughout our daily lives, what are the connections that link something that is going on, let's say, in the world of technology with something that is going on in the world of population growth, right? Or vice versa. And it is those lateral connections that I think bring to our attention as human beings where the big threats might be, but also where the big opportunities occur. And I think that's why I decided to frame the book entirely in terms of this lateral thinking, in terms of all of those unexpected connections that we need to be paying attention to in order to succeed as workers, as consumers, as investors.
By the way, is lateral thinking a term that's original with you, or is this sort of an accepted or term of art, if you will?
It is something that has been used over the last 30 years or so. Edward de Bono, proposed one version of it, the best-selling author about 30 years ago or so. And then my colleague, George Day, who's a marketing professor at Wharton, also emphasized a related concept, which is called peripheral vision, right? So how important it is to look, sideways if you want to really understand what's going on in the world.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's a parallel to something you discuss later in the book where you talk about technology. There's sometimes technology comes out a little too early, or some of the technologies that are now sort of ubiquitous are based on things that have been lying around for a while. They've been just brought out and updated, and I guess they've met their moment.
Yeah, oftentimes what happens, and this is the case, for example, with tablets, with iPads and so on, is that there's an inventor, there's a company that brings it to market, and it fails, it flops. And it's only 5 years later, 10 years later, that somebody else comes along, in this case, Steve Jobs and Apple, and they figure out exactly what is the way of making that product a successful one across the board.
Yeah, and I know we want to get to a whole bunch of things. I don't want to get bogged down in this, but I also thought that piece where you're talking about these small systematic improvements, it really is, I've always thought, and I thought you brought that out in very, very vivid detail, how Apple's success is based not on any big revolutionary idea, but on all of these incremental improvements that ultimately add up to something big.
Exactly, and that's why Steve Jobs is normally referred to as the tweaker, as opposed to the inventor, right? He wasn't like Thomas Edison. He was more of a tweaker, but he made all of those great ideas and inventions so much easier to use and so much useful to all of us.
Yeah, it's like Apple's success is based in part on, to your point, if you have a two-step process or a three-step process and you can make a three-step process a two-step process, voila.
Absolutely. And that oftentimes delivers better results. You see, contrary to the conventional wisdom, we tend to all assume that everything that changes the world is like the product of some mind that invented something, while thinking, about a big problem in the world. And that's not what usually happens, right?
Yeah.
One of the topics you discuss is what the Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter called creative destruction. Now, you cite AI, robotics, and later in the book, blockchain technology and how they threaten to displace workers, where by 2030, there will be more robots than workers, whereas the first wave of automation and AI technology displaced relatively unskilled labor. Advances in these technologies are threatening highly trained people as well. In the book, you describe the evolution of the wristwatch and how a sequence of technologies put the dominant watchmaking companies out of business as new ones emerged. Some people view disruptive technology as the time-honored natural state of affairs and think concerns about AI putting vast swaths of people out of work is overstated. It's simply a matter of reskilling a guaranteed national income, among other so-called remedies. How should we apply lateral thinking to this scenario?
So that's a great question, Tom. And I think the way to do it is the following. I think we normally have this inclination to think about these new technologies, including AI, as a substitute for human, you know, thinking or for the human brain. I think the correct course of action, as many entrepreneurs, such as, for example, Elon Musk, have proposed, is that these technologies should be complements, right? So we should be looking for ways in which AI can help us be better decision makers, can help us be better workers, and so on and so forth. Now, having said that, it is simply unavoidable that new powerful technologies will reshape the labor market and will render certain occupations, well, not as useful, right, as before. And therefore, entire, you know, classes of people may be finding themselves without a job. And that's why we also need both governments and corporations to think carefully about what are the implications of all of this. And in particular, AI, because I'm sure you realize that the moment we can have a computer making decisions based on algorithms, even as complex as, for example, how to put together a legal contract, right? Then, you know, you can have a lot of people, in this case, young lawyers, who cannot find as many good paying jobs as they used to, right? And so we're also, I think, thinking all the time that automation, AI, all of these things will only affect unskilled workers. And we also need to, you know, start realizing that it's going to affect even occupations for which you have to go to school for 20 or more years, right? Counting from kindergarten. So physicians, doctors, lawyers, and professors like myself, right? And of course, we need to train these people to become effective in that new AI-centered environment. I think that is the name of the game, right? Unfortunately, as you know, and this is my last comment on this point, universities, educational institutions, they change very slowly. We change very slowly. And it takes a long time to educate or to train a new generation of people in those new technologies, right? So that's the challenge, right?
Yeah. So are you saying that AI may come to the point where it could displace people like you? That's impossible.
Well, I think it is going to change the way in which professors perform their duties as professors, certainly. And again, the good professor will not be the one who can outsmart the machine. I think that's the wrong mindset. The good professor will be the one who thinks laterally and comes up with ways in which he or she can incorporate AI into what is being done in the classroom and outside the classroom to the benefit of students. I think the goal should be not to preserve those jobs so that my job, you know, I always have my job until I retire, but rather to offer the students the best possible learning experience. Right?
Yes.
And so think laterally, how can I incorporate all of this? How can I incorporate, for example, the kind of technology that we're using right now for this podcast? And I have already been doing that, not only during the pandemic, but also before the pandemic struck, right?
Yeah. You know, by the way, I also want to mention one of the real great aspects of your book, all the anecdotes and all the things that I never knew before. For instance, going to the watch anecdote that Tom referred to, I didn't know that Rolex actually originally was a London-based company.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that, you know, we think of the Swiss as, you know, their native genius and watchmakers. But if I have it right, if I remember correctly, they were persecuted French Huguenots.
Exactly. Who migrated across the border.
Yeah. who'd have thunk?
Yeah.
You know,
that happened 500 years ago.
Yeah, no. So the book is just full of that kind of stuff, which, again, makes it such a fun read on top of just being provocative and interesting. You talk about the emergence of the sharing or collaborative economy and the quote-unquote jobless worker that it facilitates, where the concepts of job and office, ownership and access are blurred. While your book doesn't speak to the pandemic, which I assume began to unfold after you turned in your final manuscript, but it's sort of the elephant in the room, or the elephant in the ebook, if you will, which probably only accelerates these trends, particularly as more companies embrace the idea of increasingly remote workforces. What do these trends, the collaborative economy, remote work, even tech-driven disruption, portend for the future of work? Of course, viewing all this through the lens of lateral thinking. You know, put another way, what can executives, entrepreneurs, managers do to prepare for what's ahead, particularly from the standpoint of acquiring, managing, motivating, and retaining talent?
Yeah, that's a great question, Charles. And in the book, by the way, I did add a postscript in which I discuss precisely the issue that you put your finger on, which is that the pandemic accelerates many of the trends mm-hmm. that I discuss in the book, and I provide examples. But going to your question, I think the really important thing is that once we have technology-mediated work, like in my case as a professor, or in your case as a podcaster, or in so many other different kinds of jobs and occupations, a whole new universe opens up. Remote work is one possibility, but also hybrid work in the sense that maybe people will work from home a couple of days a week, and then they will go to the office 3 days because otherwise they may go crazy just working from home, and coordination may suffer and all of that. But then the other very important thing is the other aspect that you touched on, which is the jobless worker, the gig economy, right? And the fact that we have increasingly groups of people, some of them highly educated, but not all of them, who essentially prefer that kind of an arrangement. And let me tell you something, and here's an example of lateral thinking. The fact that for the first time by the year 2030, we're going to have more grandparents than grandchildren, meaning that we're going to have a very large proportion of the population above the age of 60, is only going to fuel that growth. Because many people now realize when they turn 60 or 65, and we have 12,000 of them, by the way, every day celebrating their 60th birthday here in the United States. So it's growing very quickly. What they're realizing is that maybe the money that they save is not enough because now they're living longer, right, on average. And so they would like to do some work also because otherwise they will get bored. But they want to make some more money. So I think the pressure, the thrust behind this gig economy is just unstoppable. And it's going to be great for the economy because, by the way, a 60 or a 65 or a 70-year-old today is not the same as a 70-year-old 20 years ago or 30 years ago. That person is still in very good shape mentally and physically and can continue to contribute to society and may be very much willing to work part-time on something from home using remote work technology. And that worker is going to have a lot of experience. It's going to be great for the economy, for the American economy, if we can somehow tap into that talent.
Our guest is Wharton professor and author Mauro Guillen, who holds the Zanman Professorship in International Management and teaches in its flagship Advanced Management Program and many other courses for executives, MBAs, and undergraduates. Your book states that in 2030, there will be more global wealth owned by women than men. Walk us through this. We've had a number of people on the podcast discuss gender equity and how to redress it. What are the trends that will lead to women's wealth accumulation? And how do you see this transforming businesses, business culture, and the broader economy in general?
Yeah, so this is the subject of one of the chapters in the book. And look, what's going on in most countries around the world is that women are increasingly getting an education or they're learning some kind of a skilled occupation. And they are committing more of their lives towards their careers. And therefore, they're making their own money. They're making progress. There's still discrimination in pay when you compare men and women in the same occupation. I'm not denying that. But women are making a lot of progress. Even in the United States, what we're seeing is that nearly 40% of households now, where there's a man and a woman, the woman is the one who makes more money in that household, okay, has the highest income. And by the year 2030, it will be 50%. But then the other thing that is fueling this is very simple, which is that women live longer, right? I have very bad news for you, Tom and Charles, and also for myself, right? Oh, yeah. So on average, we're not going to live as long as the women in our lives. And the issue here is the following, which is that they live longer, and as a result, they have more time to accumulate wealth, and, of course, they're also more likely to inherit, right, wealth from somebody else, normally their partner or spouse. So that's the issue, right? The issue is that there are certain structural characteristics here in place that if we give women more opportunities and they stay in school and they acquire knowledge and skills that are useful in the labor market. And then not only that, we're also seeing, of course, many more women than in the past launching ventures, so going into entrepreneurship. So once again, I am not denying that there is discrimination. But yes, the forecast by the year 2030 is that more than half of the net worth in the world will be owned by women at that point.
Yeah, that's just amazing. You know, the chapter on immigration was also really fascinating and a real eye-opener, particularly in how you frame many of the misconceptions around the issue as stemming from loss aversion bias, where we tend to prefer avoiding losses than locking in equivalent gains, which goes back to the aforementioned Messrs. Tversky and Kahneman. Please explain how this framing clouds our thinking about immigration and why immigration, in your view, is a net gain for our economy and how it drives innovation.
Yes, so the public's perception of immigration, not just here in the United States, but also in other developed countries, for example, in Europe, is that we tend to pay more attention and give more credence, give more weight to the negative aspects of immigration. It's like, oh, they're coming here, they're going to be using our social services, or they're going to be stealing jobs away from us. And we very rarely tend to think about the positives. And the positives, to the second part of your question, are very straightforward to see. First is most immigrants are a relatively young age, working age. So they actually help us increase the number of people who are paying social security taxes, among other things. And at a time when our population is aging very quickly, it helps us rebalance the age structure in such a way that our pension system, for example, can be financially viable for a longer period of time. The other thing, by the way, is that we bring from outside of the United States about a third of the doctors and the nurses that we need in our healthcare system. So it's going to be really difficult to meet the healthcare demands of our rapidly aging population without immigration. Now, again, we could also look at entrepreneurship. Google, Tesla, you name them. I mean, many of the companies that have contributed so much to technology development, so much to job creation in this country, were either founded or co-founded by immigrants. And don't get me wrong, we also need immigration for unskilled jobs because there's not enough Americans who want to take those jobs. So the benefits, I think, are there for everyone clear to see, right? But of course, there are, you know, also frictions and costs. But our human tendency, as you said, right, is essentially, it predisposes us to attach more weight to the potential losses than to the potential gains. And that is unfortunate, I think.
You also have some very interesting insights into how we view and often draw overly broad or in many cases the wrong conclusions about different generations and their shared tendencies. In one section, you mentioned gray is the new black, how 70 is the new 55, and describe various misconceptions about their lifestyles and interests. And you also mentioned that people are working longer and the value companies derive from intergenerational workforces. What are some of the key misconceptions we have in our perceptions of these different generations?
Yeah, so I think that we have been brought up in a world in which, you know, we go through different stages. First, we study, and then we work, and then we retire. And, you know, I think this made sense when life expectancy was 35 or 40 years old on average. Remember, that's what was going on in this country 100 years ago. But it's no longer a good way of thinking about, you know, the issue. I think our conception of what is young and what is old needs to change. And by the way, going to school only once when so many things are changing, technology is, you know, reconfiguring entire industries, we may have to go back to school several times in our lifetime. And why stop working when you're 60 or 62 or 65 now that you are still expected to live another 25 years on average, right? So all of these assumptions that we've been making for the last 100 years, I think, we're going to have to revisit in a serious way.
You know, it's interesting on LinkedIn earlier today, just so happened, somebody put up a post and said, you know, I'm tired of all these 40 under 40 lists. What I want to see is somebody who got their PhD at the age of 60.
Right.
You know, something like that. And I think you're going to see more and more of that. In fact, a friend of mine just did that. He is a family physician, and he just on a whim, he saw an ad or something like this. And on weekends, he got his MBA through this program at Cornell. And mm-hmm. he would go up there every other weekend and do the work, go to the lectures. And so it's pretty amazing. And by the way, just one other thought on this whole immigration piece. I think in the book, either you stated this, or you had somebody speak to this, that immigration is itself a form of entrepreneurship. You know, and
Absolutely.
It requires all those skills, just the process of coming over here, you know, the grit, the ingenuity, all the things that go into being an entrepreneur are really part and parcel of the immigration experience.
Absolutely. To the extent that you believe that entrepreneurship is all about taking the initiative, taking risks, and sailing towards the unknown, I think then we're clearly right seeing then a very strong connection between entrepreneurship and immigration. And by the way, a greater percentage of immigrants become entrepreneurs than the percentage for the average, for the total population here in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, as far as risk taking, you have a couple of really good quotes at the end of the book. There's a Faulkner quote that was particularly good, and others, which actually brings me to your conclusion, which I think succinctly captures the gist of your book. And let me just quote a line here. Quote, "Seeing the unseeable has been my mission in 2030. The effort to visualize a metaphorical black hole, if you will, of an emerging world remade by shifting demographics, global warming, technological disruption, and geopolitical disarray." Are we doomed?
End no.
Well, no. That's your quote. No, you asked it. Are we doomed?
It is
so
a quote.
So I have to ask you, Professor. Well, I assume we're not doomed by your response.
No, as you know, at every turn in the book, I try to put a positive spin on things.
Yes.
I think that yes, there are many threats. And some people, when they consider the threats that I discuss in the book, will feel threatened by them. But immediately, the following paragraph, I always point out, but listen, there's an opportunity here as well. So once again, we're going back to our mental biases, right? We need to not think so much about the potential losses, and we need to rotate our thinking more towards the potential gains. And that is the message in the book as well. The quote is accurate, but what I would add right now is, look, try to turn every threat, every challenge into an opportunity. That is the game, the name of the game, especially when so many things are changing simultaneously in the world.
Well, you have a great Churchill quote that speaks to that. The pessimist sees difficulty in every opportunity, while the optimist sees opportunity in every difficulty. I think that does sort of capture that idea.
Absolutely.
Again, terrific book. And we actually had to winnow down. We had more questions. We can go into global warming and nanotechnology. There's just so much stuff packed into what? How many pages actually is it? Again, the ebook sometimes is misleading. And my ebook is something like 267 pages, something like that.
Yeah, it's nearly 300 pages.
Nearly 300 pages.
The references and all of the material at the back of the book.
Yeah. Again, if you buy the book, it is a page turner. And if you don't and you're using the ebook, it indeed is a page swiper. So really wish you all the best. And it's on the Wall Street Journal bestseller list, and deservedly so. And I recommend anybody, you know, particularly anybody who's interested in this kind of stuff. And there are quite a few people, you know, the Harari book, the work of Tversky and Kahneman. I mean, it's just fascinating stuff. And I think, you know, you're right in that pocket. And, you know, but obviously it's your original stuff and original insights. And I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Thank you so much, Charles. And the questions that you asked, I think, are extremely important for all of us to think very carefully about.
The name of the book is 2030, How Today's Biggest Trends Will Collide and Reshape the Future of Everything. And it is currently on the Wall Street Journal's bestseller list, and it is available wherever you buy books. It is it's a scroll breaker, from what Charles is telling me. If you keep scrolling, you're going to need to order a new scrolling device. I don't know. Well, thank you so much, Professor, for joining us. We really do appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Tom and Charles, for having me.
Professor Mauro Guillen from the Wharton School and a professorship, the Zandman Professorship in International Management and Advanced Management Programs for executives, MBAs, and undergraduates. It's a mouthful, but it is certainly, it was a true pleasure speaking with you. He spoke to us today from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This is Work in Progress, back in a moment.
Pay equity matters, and not just because it reduces legal risk. It has profound ramifications on company culture, engagement, recruiting, and retaining top people. Syndio is a data science-powered software platform that enables modern organizations to close the gender pay gap while reducing costly unwanted attrition and improving true engagement and collaboration. Studies show the pay gap will be around for another 200 years. 200 years! Go to www.synd.io. SYND.io.
Up Work in Progress along with Charles Epstein. I'm Tom Alexander. And Charles, boy, what a fascinating conversation we had with Professor Guillen.
Yeah, I tell you, you know, I'm not really a big fan of business books. So I didn't know exactly what to expect. But I tell you, as I said in the conversation, it genuinely was a page turner, and he covered so much ground in 200 some odd pages, and it's not like he just skimmed over it. It was all really woven together, tethered to really good, illuminating, very vivid anecdotes and stories. Just really, really terrific. And as I said, when we close with him, we're finishing up. Yeah. That you know, it's nice to see that the book is getting some early recognition because it really is that good. By the way, we could have spoken with him at least for another half hour.
At least.
I mean, yeah. There are just so many things I would have loved to dig into. For instance, how using nanotechnology in manufacturing clothing, 3D printing, vertical agriculture could reduce global warming. Yeah. The various applications of blockchain technology beyond cryptocurrency for smart contracts, protecting the IP of artists, etc. And again, it's just strewn with all these very interesting thoughts and insights. For instance, at one point he says, if Lehman Brothers were Lehman Sisters, we could have averted a global financial crisis.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and it's not just a tossed off line. You know, he talks about how women just tend to be more risk averse.
Yeah.
And men. So again, so many great things. And as he said, yeah, it's not a gloom and doom book. He does talk about all of these trends are opportunities if you, to use his term, think laterally.
Yeah, think laterally. That's maybe we should just get a bunch of TL t-shirts printed up and just people ask us, what does that mean?
Think laterally. Exactly. But I have to say, you know, we've had what show is this? 78, 79?
Yeah, somewhere in there. It's not late 70s.
Somewhere like that, but easily top 10 interview. I don't know how you feel.
Oh man, totally. Yeah, he was absolutely wonderful and it was just illuminating. And again, he's the kind of guy that, you know, you know, not only necessitates a second appearance, but also he's the kind of guy that you just want to sit down and open up a nice bottle of wine and have conversation and just, you know, prepare to be fascinated.
I would love to. Right. I would love to have asked him a little bit about his background. We didn't have a chance to do that. I believe he hails from Spain. He makes reference to that in the book.
Right.
I would love talking about his journey. He's been, as he said, at Wharton for about 25 years, if memory serves.
Yeah.
So, at some point, maybe we'll have him on for a round two. I think that would be quite interesting.
Absolutely, it would. And
just last thing, Tom, I just want to thank Gabriel Gantz from St. Martin's Press for arranging this.
Wonderful. Yes, thank you, Gabriel. And we hopefully we'll get some more folks from the St. Martin's roster.
And, yeah, so far we're 2 for 2.
I'll tell you, not doing too bad, are we?
Right. One of our colleagues set us up with Chris Franz, Talking Heads. That was a lot of fun. That was a very interesting interview.
Sure was.
And now Professor Mauro Guillen. So keep them coming, guys.
Please do. Please do. We would thoroughly appreciate it. For Charles Epstein, I'm Tom Alexander. Thank you so much for listening. This is Work in Progress. We'll see you next time. So long, everybody.
This has been Work in Progress, a World at Work podcast about work, life, and everything in between, with award-winning radio host Tom Alexander and Workspan's Not Safe for Work columnist Charles Epstein. For more, visit worldatwork.org/workinprogress. That's worldatwork.org/workinprogress. Join us next week for another edition of Work in Progress.